I first of all want to talk about how this conference is possible. It's not any sponsor, it's not any big company organizing this, it's not me, it is volunteers. And Dylan is volunteering today to help me organize this day. So first of all, an applause for organizing. I will forget myself later. I am introducing Dylan as well as a speaker today. We actually have been working together on some amazing open source projects, which were also super complex. And I was always complaining about 500 variables throwing around everywhere in our code base. And somebody very smart said, let's fix this and let's build something called StateDB. And it was so interesting that I invited Dylan here on stage to talk about this. Round of applause for Dylan. No, it's not yet green.
Other side?
Yeah, now it's on.
That's fine. All right. Thank you all. How is your first time?
Yeah.
Great.
So, really? Not more excited?
Keep some for the rest of the day. So I would like to talk about StateDB. Before I do, like a little, who am I? My name is Dylan Hemmerink. I work for Isovalent, which is now part of Cisco. I'm a Cilium contributor. It's like my main job, and I do. I'm a reviewer for the Cilium eBPF project, which Cilium uses. And for those of you who don't know, those are both like very Go-heavy projects. To explain why StateDB, I need to explain a little bit about Cilium. So Cilium is a cloud network product that does a lot. Won't go into it very deeply. But I like draw a very basic diagram of like all of the things that go in and out of Cilium. API servers, etcd, envoy, a bunch of things on the kernel, and even interprocess on the same nodes. And what tends to happen is a lot of information comes in, a lot of events happen, we need to reconcile all of that information, and we need to do it. We need to do it quite often with a lot of different data. So, if we look at how you store program state, one of the a very naive approach, like which is good, like to start with always, is you take a map. I put my data in a map or an array or some sort of container. Now I need to make it multi-process, so I slap a lock on there. And then we replicate this pattern. So I made an Apple manager and an Orange manager, and they manage their own little bits of data. And these have consumers. So what tends to happen is that these managers are created by different people with different goals. They take maybe the same data, maybe different data, index it differently. And you have to create some sort of API for this. So with a normal map, you would just make a lookup function, an update function, a delete function. But with a lock, you add a lock, so you can lock and defer the release whenever you do it in a function. But this doesn't always work if you need to like operate on big sets of data. So what we often have is we say, okay, we need to like loop over this map. So and to do that, we need to hold the lock the entire time because we can't have changes in the middle of looking at it. So, but you don't really like, so what ends up happening is you need to expose that lock somehow to your consumer, which is bad practice, shouldn't be done. Or you create some sort of callback mechanism where you say, okay, let me loop over all of the state that I have and call some sort of callback function while that lock is held. But in that callback function, your consumer can do anything, including, for example, talking to some other manager, taking another lock. And this causes problems. So we have data this causes some problems. And the biggest one that I found that is like actually super breaking is deadlocks. So let's say consumer one takes the lock from Apple manager and then Orange manager, and consumer two happens to do it the other way around. If they both happen to take their own locks first, like the preferred locks first, then they need to both wait for each other, and your application simply stops working. No one can proceed, and there's no way to recover from that. So to summarize, we have deadlocks, we have data duplication, which was also a thing, like you have a store, you have a map, but you need to have a key, and not every consumer wants to index on the same data. Some want to, for example, take a Kubernetes resource, index on the name, but other ones to do it on a namespace or a label set or something else. And we have a bunch of these API variations, which were really frustrating for developers, because you do it one way here, you have to do it another way here. Every time you want to use some data, you have to relearn how this specific bit of code did it. So we started looking into ways to fix this. And a big inspiration was HashiCorp Nomad. So HashiCorp Nomad is also a sort of cloud orchestration platform. And the way they dealt with distributing state is to use something called GoMemDB. So they have a Raft protocol to basically pick masters. And those masters are where you insert data and they distribute everywhere. And this distribution of data is picked up by a single thread in their system, and it takes and it writes into this in-memory database. So we looked at this, and this was like 90% of what we want, but it had a few issues. Namely, we had the single database write lock, and we typically have not one place where we insert data, but a lot of producers of data. It's an older code base, so they use the plain interface slot, and we want the type safety. And there were just a number of small little features that we wanted, and they just didn't have yet. We actually first started with this as our basis, but then we wanted to add some things. So we basically took that and rewrote it to suit our needs. So we added generics, so all of our tables have generic data types, independent write lock, so you can lock multiple tables independently or sets of tables, and also like the few other little features that we're talking about. So we can initialize tables, we can watch tables, so whenever things change, we can see what happens, metrics, nice iterators, optimistic concurrency stuff, and I won't be talking about all of this, but these are like the things that we added. So to summarize, what is this in-memory database, StateDB? So it's in memory, it doesn't persist to disk, so every time your application starts up, you get an empty database, you need to populate it yourself. Technically you can like persist it yourself, but the library just doesn't do it for you. And because it's all in memory, you can actually have very complicated data types in there, such as maps, channels, pointers, like you name it. If it's a Go type, you can store it as a value in the store, something you wouldn't be able to do on a disk easily. It has multi-version concurrency control, so multiple processes can read and write, and they don't interfere with each other. So you can have a read transaction, a write transaction going, and the read transaction will still see like all of the data consistently. We can lock across tables, so we can lock a set of tables together and then may like update them together in a transaction or not. Multiple indexes, so you always have a primary index, but you can make as many secondary indexes as you want to index that same data. And watch channels, which is a concept we took from HashiCorp. And the idea is that you can basically, you do a query, you get a channel back to see when did my query change, did the content change. So how would you use something like this? So going back to the apple, to the fruit example, I created an apple. I defined a separate apple ID. I will come back to that as part of it. So that would be the ID part of my key. And I assigned a grade, which is just an enum, a letter of A to F. And then we create a table. In this case, I'm creating a global object, global object from the table, because that's easier from a standalone perspective. In our case, we use it via dependency injection methods. So, but for like a standalone review, this is best. So we define it as a readable and writable table. You can technically also cast this to a read-only table if you want to. And we say that it stores an apple, and we give it two indexes. So the ID index is a primary index, and the apple grade index is an index on its so not on the key, but on this value, this grade value that it has. So the primary index looks something like this. So we have, so I have this Apple ID. It has a two key method. I defined this myself. It's just, it produces a byte slice where it takes three numbers that just makes one key out of it, puts it in a key set, and I take the Apple ID itself and I call the same method. So what you'll notice is I give this index a name. This is just for observability. The from object is whenever you insert an object into the database, it will call this function to translate, to get a key from your object, whatever its shape is. And from key is when you do a query. So you give a key to a query, and it will go into the database to actually find it. The unique part is, because it's a primary index, it has to be unique, but you can also have non-unique indexes. For example, the grade one is a non-unique index. If I can have multiple apples with the A grade, for example. And what I did here is I took the grade because it's an enum. I have to cast it into UInt32, and the index.UInt32 is just like predefined. We have a few predefined functions that take Go data types and turn them into keys. And again, a key is just a byte slice. Anything that can be represented as a byte slice can be indexed in the database. So we create our database, we register our table, and we start it. So this start bit is starts a background worker, which is important for a few things. I can produce a few apples. So when I produce something, I write a transaction. I say I will defer the commit. I insert my apple. And if something errors, I will abort my transaction. But you can imagine that you can do this with multiple things. I didn't take the first and the second argument that it returns, but it actually returns the old object. So if there was already an apple with the same key in there, it would return me the old apple that it has replaced. And the Boolean tells me if it did replace something or not. So this is basically an insert and or update. Getting it is fairly simple. So we do a get with a read transaction. We have to we create a query from this ID, and we would get our apple back. To read the whole table, we use a different call. So we tell the table, hey, we want to get all and watch. So every API call most API calls have this watch variant. So this returns an iterator. So these are the new iterator types, and it just returns me an iterator of Apple. And the watch is a channel, just an empty channel a channel with an empty struct, and it gets closed by the database when, in this case, because we query the whole table, if anything happens to this table, it closes the channel and notifies us that hey, your data, there's something new you can observe. We can do a prefix watch. So if you notice here I have orchard, tree, and a number. Here I only have the orchard and the tree. So this is only the first part of my key, and I can basically say give me every apple from this orchard and this tree, and it will give me everything with that prefix in the key. And you can use this for IP addresses, strings, stuff like this. So what is a practical example of this? So this is how sort of the how we use it. So we have a bunch of resources on the top. They live in the Kubernetes API server. We have a gRPC watch that goes into a component called recaller reflector. This is not part of the library, but something we built in Cilium. They go into tables, and these tables can then be observed. And the cool thing about this infrastructure is that you have the tables as an abstraction layer between all of your components, meaning that if I wanted to test my LB reflector, I can, in my test, leave out the actual reflectors and the map, and I can just create a bunch of information in my tables. This is my input, and then I can assert that after it looked at it, that it produced the exact output to my lower tables that I expected. So I can test my components in isolation. It's also extensible, so like we've got a few arrows going off to other components that need to use the same information. And if some component needs to index it, then we just add a new index to the existing table, and we don't have to create a completely separate data store. So how does this internally work? It's actually a really cool data structure behind it called an immutable adaptive radix tree. So to explain it, we'll first start at a radix tree. For those who don't know, I added 6 objects in here. And what a radix tree does is so it's essentially the idea of a binary tree where you sort your keys. But you can, instead of having instead of having 2 children, you can have 255 children. So it's basically a tree where your nodes get very, very big. The yellow ones are my nodes. So this is what something would look like, and everything with a common prefix. Everything with a common prefix shares nodes in this way. The adaptive bit of this has to do with how the data gets represented. So a normal radix would be the picture above, where you would use 255 pointers for every time you get a byte, you can basically look that up in an array and get your next node. But 255 is very big if you have a sparse set. So what the adaptive radix tree does is it picks smaller nodes if you have less data in there. This is essentially an implementation detail. There are 4 different nodes. So the small node, it gets represented like this. So you just have an array of your keys and your pointers, and you simply loop over them to find the next one because that's just faster than modern CPUs. And then only when you need to do very big, when you actually have very wide trees, you scale up internally to use bigger nodes. And this is both faster in lookup and also memory use. The immutable part is the thing that makes the database actually work. So if we go back to our radix, what if you want to update this? So let's say I'm going to add a testing node to this. So the steps would be for an immutable radix tree. So we cannot change the existing nodes. We create a new root. We know that T is a shared node. So we basically take the existing T, we copy it. So we copy also the existing link it has. We know that EST is a node. So this is both a leaf node and so it has a value in it and also goes further. So we copy it and then we put our ing under it. So now we have 2 copies of this bit. If you look at this, from the new point, I can still access all of the same nodes that I would be able to from the left, except it also has testing. So I basically created sort of diff between if I were to just modify the tree, I just add the difference. From our immutable radix, the way this would work is we have a consumer that says, oh, give me the root node. So it gets the old one. Now the update happens, so these green ones get added. We switch the pointer over, so it's a sort of RCU change, and then the new node comes along and says, oh, give me the root of the tree. It gets the new one. And this is how our versioning works at a basic level. So the new consumer can see the new version, the old consumer can't see the new changes, and they can both independently operate on this. Now the moment the consumer one goes away, there are no longer any pointers to this root, so it gets actually garbage collected by the Go runtime itself. It just automatically goes away, and we can rearrange the tree, and from then on it just seems as if the tree always had it like this. So we have a sort of generational radix tree that keeps growing and going. When you want to use this in a database, we extend this out. So you start with a database, with the database root. The root has a bunch of tables, and every table has multiple indexes. Every index is actually one of these immutable radix trees. This is not a radix tree, but it uses the same principle. So every time we update a table or an index, we make a copy of the header of that index, of that table, and we do a generational copy, and then we just switch the root database pointer. So the way these queries work is because we have this tree, we can exploit its properties to do queries. So if we wanted to query a very specific object, we simply, because we know that we that they are sorted from less to more, we can just basically do a sort of binary search through our tree. But we can also do the prefix. This is a lower bound search. So you basically say, I want to have this key and everything that is more than this key. So we can we basically get a split, and from that point on, you can traverse the tree from left to right all the way until you find all of the leaves. You can also do a prefix search. So you say, okay, this is my prefix, and then you can traverse the whole subtree. So this way, we can do a bunch of these queries. Secondary indexes work like such. So a primary index is just our, so I just made a primary index with one byte for now. They point to objects, and this is a unique one, so every key points to exactly one object, and they can't be null. Our objects in the below want to have this foo property, which is a slice, so we store a slice in there, and we can actually index on that slice. So we create a foo index. We take the primer, so we take that value, we index it, so we get bar or baz, and then every bar or baz points to one or more, or points to the actual objects. But they're still the same objects. Whenever we did this moving, so whenever we duplicated it, we actually copied the objects, which is something to remember about this, because if some objects that don't like shallow clones, then it isn't ideal for storage in here, because then you get very weird issues. And I told you about the watches, so I showed you where this channel comes from. And the way this works is every header, so this is the header of every node, never mind which of the four versions it is. It has some flags, it has the prefix, so we can compress a prefix, so we don't just have one byte for one node, but we can have path compression. And it has this watch channel. And what happens is whenever we did the cloning, we have a transaction. Our transaction keeps track of which objects were replaced by a new version. And whenever we commit that transaction, we basically just loop that list of everything that's changed, and we close the watch channels. And because we do the prefix searches, or a specific one, we can just pick one of the nodes and return that watch channel. And when anything changes that is relevant to your query, that is the way you get notified. So transactions. So I talked about the transactions. What happens on commits? So on abort, because we have this generational copying, whenever you make a copy and you decide, oh, I don't want to use this copy, you can just remove all references to the copy and let it be collected by the garbage collector. There's no additional work in doing an abort. Just whenever you say, I don't want this transaction, it just gets collected. And the interesting bit, so I talked in the beginning about about deadlocks. We use something called a sortable mutex, and I'm going to explain it with a sort of mini animation. So let's say we have five tables, and I have some write transaction that wants to take 2, 4, and 5. That's possible, they are available, so they get taken. And the rule with sortable mutexes is that you always take them from left to right. So you first take 2, then 4, then 5. So let's say a second transaction comes along that wants to lock 3 tables. It can lock 1, that's no problem. But 2 is already taken, so now it does a mutex.lock, and it will block. But because we always do it from left to right, and the reverse when unlocking, it means that this will be okay. Let's say another one comes along, 3. 3 is still available, so this one can be taken. This thread will just go on. So we don't only the middle transaction is waiting until it can access the tables. Our old one goes away. and then we can start looking too, but now we still have to wait. So, but we progress, so every write transaction will always progress, and it also ensures a level of fairness. It's not perfect, scheduling-wise, but because you always lock and unlock in this ordering, you can basically guarantee that you're never that you're never going in the opposite direction. You never have two people waiting for each other's locks that are held, and that that solves our locking issue. So the last thing I wanted to show is the change tracking, which I find one of the best features in here. So what you can do is you can say I have a table and I want to watch all of the changes that happens since the last time that I did something. So you can basically do one big query, process something, and then from then on only process the differences. So you take you need to take a write transaction to create to get this change iterator, and that's because it does a few things in the background which you need a log for on the table. But after you've done that, we take a write transaction, and with a read transaction, and with a read transaction, we just say, okay, I'm at this point. What happened between the last time I checked and this new point? And you can iterate over all of the changes, and it tells you is it deleted, and what is the object that was there, or what's the new object that has been inserted or updated. To do this, we have a hidden index called the revision index, which always exists. And it's every time you have a transaction, every transaction gets an incrementing number, and all changes made in that transaction are tracked. So we can do this lower bound search where you say, give me everything that is above this number, above the on the revision index, to basically give us a sort of history from a certain revision. This works for new objects, but not for the ones that are deleted. So for deleted, whenever you have a change, whenever you are watching changes, we create, we mark that. Whenever something then gets deleted, it goes to a sort of soft delete state, so the graveyard index, which is another primary index, but for all the objects that are deleted. When you observe that something was deleted, a background worker that we did with the db.start will remove these old ones. So it allows you to basically temporarily store the deleted objects until everyone that's interested in deleted objects has observed them, and then they will automatically go away. So that was all that I have time for. I have so much more to show you. Please go have a look at StateDB. And I would like to, so I am here speaking, but actually my colleague Yussi did most of the legwork on this. I was just his professional user, so I had some influence on the design and on how and working out bugs, but Yussi is the real hero here. Questions?
Applause!
Don't know if we have next questions on that.
I don't have time for questions. If you have questions, Dylan is here all day. Just don't bother him during the busiest moments of the day. Thank you.